Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here at the undisclosed location somewhere deep inside the European continent. And with me here tonight is John Morgan. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Nick. It's great to finally be here.
I've wanted to get you on this show, wanted to have a conversation with you ever since we got the Writer's Block rolling, but these things, you know, they're a little complicated. Wheels are always in motion. The wheels of nationalism grind with unbelievably slow momentum. I'm trying to say something clever and witty, but I seem to be completely out of brain. I did some activities this morning. Well, we are online. The show is underway, so I guess there's no backing out of this at this late hour. And you are in my show. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
So anyways, before we get into it, I would like to remind people that Countercurrents is having a fundraiser. We are raising funds, so to speak. You can donate to us through Entropy Stream and Cash App, right? So, and these are the links flashing underneath us on the banner. And if the moderators would be kind enough to post the links to Entropy and Cash App into the DLive and Odyssey chats. And of course, you can send us money through Cash App. The provision is lower, so we get more money. However, if you send us money on Entropy, you get to ask us questions. You get to give us comments. If you've ever burned to ask myself or Mr. John Morgan a question, I know Mr. John Morgan doesn't make a lot of these appearances. So this may be a rare chance to ask him something to avail ourselves of his hard-earned wisdom. And yeah, I've spoken to Mr. Morgan many times before. His wisdom is truly hard-earned. And of course, Let's not forget a word for our sponsors at Alaska Chaga Tea. Alaska Chaga is, of course, what fuels me, what nationalist racist podcasters crave. It's got, I don't know if it has electrolytes, but it does have antioxidants. It ensures I have a good night's sleep and good bowel motions. So you should always drink Alaska Chaga. And plus, It's delicious. It tastes divine. It smells divine. And one day, we're going to develop technology to live stream smell. And I will live stream the smell of Alaska Chaga into every bedroom on the North American continent. That is my fiendish master plan for the future. Oh, I shouldn't have said that out loud. But do visit alaskachaga.us and purchase their fine products. There's also soap. You know, I hear some people like to clean themselves with soap. Personally, I just roll around in local puddles. But hey, to each their own. If I could only live stream that smell and taste. It is indeed a wonderful, wonderful beverage. Although it is coming to be the hot season here in Europe, it's coming to be the summer, the late spring. I'm going to have to try it chilled, like chilled and sweetened, like the American Southerners do. It might be a new experience for me. Well, I think that's all of the crass financial concerns taken care of. Let's just ease into the show. Let's just dip our toe into it. John, this is your first time on the Writer's Block, and well, I'm sure you know most of the audience knows who John Morgan is, right? Let's begin with your basic introduction. Who are you to nationalists? Who are you in nationalism?
Well, I guess I've been active for about 15 years now. I started a small publishing company with some buddies of mine back in 2006 called Integral Tradition Publishing. And then we did that for a few years, but didn't really produce that much. We got a few books out, but then we moved the operation to India, which enabled us to do it full time. And we did it from there. And then it became a publishing company that I'm sure is much more familiar to people called Arcdos. And I was one of the people who started that. And I was the editor-in-chief there for about 7 years. And then I've also been writing for Countercurrents almost from the beginning, because I've known Greg for a long time. I've worked as an editor for Countercurrents before, and I've I've also given some talks at American Renaissance and done a hell of a lot of podcasts over the years. Not as many lately as I used to, but especially with movies. I've probably done about a million movie podcasts. So I'm actually glad to be talking about something other than movies tonight. So yeah, that's probably how people know me.
Yeah. Yeah. People in the chat are saying, oh, isn't this the guy who did Europa on Frodi's Decameron Film Festival? Yeah. Yes. I know you're a movie buff. I know you're friendly with the movies. But tonight we are going to be devoting our attentions to that long forgotten art of writing and reading. I hear a lot of people don't know how to read these days. Well, we have not forgotten. We are still writing. This is, I know. Ancient technology, but old habits die hard, and you can't teach old dogs new tricks. And you and I were getting a little long in the tooth, John. I would say it's just one of those things. And this is a best month ever type show, which means that we're going to take the most exciting, most incisive articles I have discovered on countercurrents.com this month of April, well, this past month of April, and we're going to discuss them with a valued contributor to Countercurrents. This is how the best month ever goes on the writer's block. And this is John's first time doing a best month ever, and he's a treasure. So let's just dive into it. Now, John, you wrote something which I found very informative and also heartening, which, you know, or as the kids like to say, white-pilling, which is about the victory of nationalists in Hungary. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're living in Hungary right now.
Yes. Yes, right. That's true. And I would just say that I you're referring to the article I wrote, So Much Winning in Hungary. But if people really want to fully understand the whole context behind it, I published another article 2 days before that one, kind of outlining the whole political situation in Hungary today. And if you want to know even more about it, you can click on my name and you'll find all sorts of articles I've written over the last 7 or 8 years about Hungarian politics, and you'll probably know more about it than you would ever want to if you read them all.
Yes, it is a fascinating thing. From what I've understood, right? They are a bit of an insular culture. Hungarians, they don't write about themselves. They don't say much about themselves in the English language sphere. So it's important to have someone who is a part of the nationalist movement in Hungary who can provide an insight into a country where you could say the nationalist movement is far stronger than, say, America, the United Kingdom, or France. So if you would just give us the basic lay of the land with regard to the Hungarian political parties, and have there been any changes in their landscape in this last election?
Well, it's true. Just to comment on what you said before about them being a very insular culture, that's really an outgrowth of their language, which bears no connection to any. It's not an Indo-European language. It's originally a Central Asian language. The only other languages in Europe that Hungarian is connected to are Estonian and Finnish. And I've talked to citizens of all of these countries, and they can't understand each other anyway. So that they're basically isolated from the rest of Europe linguistically. And their history, Hungarian history, over the last 500 years has been the history of them being conquered by various great powers in the region, and generally getting pushed around and being on the losing side of just about every war they've been in, yet somehow surviving and remaining Hungarian. So I think this has given them a unique wellspring for their sense of national identity, and this feeds into the politics here, because Hungarians still do have a very strong sense of their own identity. They haven't lost that yet. At the same time, I'm not going to pretend that everything is great here. I mean, the same modernizing destructive trends that we find in the West are active here as well, even if they're not as far along yet. Maybe we can talk about that later, because you know, that's a big subject in itself. But as far as the political lay of the land, well, I'm sure most listeners probably know have heard the name of Viktor Orban, the Hungarian prime minister. And his political party is called Fidesz. And they have now been in power for the last 12 years continuously. And with this victory, they're getting another four. And I mean, I don't want to make any predictions that are ill-founded, but I mean, if current trends continue, it's entirely possible they could continue ruling for another 12 years, because the leftist opposition here is so pathetic and horrible. It's literally comical. I mean, you would laugh at some of the things the opposition did in this last election. Although ironically, the largest opposition party for the last 8 years has been a purported right-wing party called Jobbik. And they did seem to be a very good party. In fact, more interesting than Fidesz in many ways when they first came on the scene. But they adopted this rather bizarre strategy that where they wanted to unite the radical right, which was their original base, with the liberal left in Hungary, which has been very weak and disorganized and disunited since 2010, when Viktor Orban ousted them after they succeeded in bankrupting the country and then lying about it, and then were exposed and were forced to, Hungary was forced to take out loans from the IMF and the European Bank just to stay afloat. So that basically cost the left whatever credibility they had up to that time, and they've never really succeeded in recovering from that. So Jobbik made the bizarre choice to ally with these people, and in the process alienated most of the right-wing voters that had been part of their base for more than a decade prior to this time. This is about 2015 is when they started to make this shift. It was a gradual process, not an overnight thing. And in the first election that they tried this strategy in, which was 4 years ago in 2018, they actually did succeed in expanding slightly their parliamentary base, but not by much, certainly not anywhere near enough to actually come to power. And then so they went even further to the left in the last 4 years. And the only thing that they can show for it is that they've now lost half of their MPs. And they're now the third largest opposition party. There's now the main one is now one called the Democratic Coalition, which is headed by Orban's old nemesis from the 2000s, the former prime minister, Ferenc Gyurcsány, who, you know, as I mentioned before, bankrupted the country. So, we can't say that that strategy worked out very well for Jobbik. But on the plus side, there's a new small, we would say in the West, radical right, although I don't think Hungarians see them as particularly radical, party called Mi Hazánk, which was launched by some disgruntled former Jobbik members and is led by a gentleman named László Toretzky, who's a longtime nationalist activist in Hungary and is respected by many people. And under Hungarian law, like in many European countries, you have to get at least 5% of the votes in order to enter parliament. And Mi Hazánk, which means our homeland, they met that requirement and actually exceeded it slightly. So they're, if I remember correctly, they're going to have 6 MPs in the new government. So that was actually, for me, the best story of the night, because it wasn't that surprising that Fidesz won, although they won much bigger than was expected by most. But really, for me, the best story was the fact that Mi Hazánk is now going to be part of the opposition. Well, not part in the sense that they're going to be working with the leftist parties, but in the sense that they will be in the parliament challenging Orban and Fidesz, and hopefully forcing them further to the right.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is interesting because, again, nationalism in the West is nowhere near as strong. Would you say that there is a similarity, not obviously not in scale, but in ideology, in political positions, Would you say there is any sort of comparison between Micha Zank and, say, I don't know, Patriotic Alternative in the United Kingdom or National Justice Party in America? If there are American, British, French equivalents of Micha Zank, what would they be?
Not really, because in Hungary, you can afford to be more quote-unquote radical than in Western Europe, what's allowed. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, yes, but also the issues that they deal with are often very specific to Hungary. Like, we don't have any significant problem with immigrants in Hungary yet, fortunately. Mm-hmm. So that's not really even an issue. That's just something that's taken for granted here. But the problem they do have is with the gypsies, who are a rising minority. And, I mean, Fidesz, Orban's party, does not present itself as a pro-gypsy party, but in action, they actually are. It's well established that they court the gypsy vote and, tolerate them. And gypsies are generally disliked by the Hungarian populace and are seen as being disproportionately responsible for crime, which is probably something that sounds familiar to many people in the West listening to this. So Micha Zank speaks out about these issues, although also Orban really, this is surprising to a lot of my Western European and American friends when I tell them, but Orban's response to the COVID pandemic was basically the same as what you would find among left liberals in the US and Western Europe. We were under lockdown and curfew for about 9 months during the pandemic. And wow. They had mandatory vaccination introduced for many things, not for the entire population, fortunately, but for a period, it was basically impossible to go to certain types of events without having the vax. They authorized employers to require the vax. Even in some cases, children were required to get the vax. So if you are a COVID and a vaccine skeptic, as I am, these were disappointing developments in Fidesz. So the only party that took up the COVID issue in opposition to all this was Micha Zank, and I think that's to their credit. So you could say the two major issues that they dealt with in this last election were COVID and the gypsy issue was basically what they pushed the most. So, yeah, in that sense, they're quite interesting and needed in Hungary. So, yeah, we'll see how things develop if COVID is really...
How do they approach the gypsy question? I mean, obviously, as someone who's from the Balkans, who's from Macedonia, I'm familiar with the gypsy question. I'm, to my great chagrin, very familiar with the gypsy question. If gypsies are in Hungary are anywhere anything like gypsies in Macedonia, then they are a serious problem which needs to be addressed. But how would you say Micha Zank approaches the gypsy questions? What are the solutions they offer to this issue? I'm interested. I'm curious.
It's mostly just the fact that they highlight the things that Fidesz doesn't want to talk about, which is the fact that they are responsible for crime, disproportionate rates and so forth. I haven't heard any specific policy proposals for how they want to deal with it. I think that's really something I should probably ask them about. I would like to do another interview about them more for Countercurrents. But really, in the election, they were focusing in the run-up more on the COVID issue. But mostly what the rhetoric that I heard from them was just pointing out the fact that, you know, there is a gypsy problem and trying to highlight this. You cannot get away, as you know, in a European Union member state, as Hungary is, with openly talking about the JQ. But Micha Zank comes as close to it as they can. You know, often, like Jobbik used to do, they often use Israel as a proxy for... and they've often made condemnatory statements about Israel. So, yeah, they basically try to highlight the things that Fidesz doesn't want to talk about. And probably what might be interesting for listeners to know is that I've heard that the people behind the Don't Say Gay law in Florida in the U.S. openly admitted that they were inspired by the law that was passed in Hungary last year, which forbade the ability of schools in Hungary to teach about homosexuality or transgenderism to grade school students. It also increased the penalties for pedophilia, a couple of other related issues. It's interesting how that developed because it wasn't initially a Fidesz thing. It was Mihozank, when they were still a very new party, who made this one of their major issues. And in August of 2020, there was a new left-wing city government in Budapest that had been elected the previous year. And they put the LGBTQ, WERTYUIOP, as I call it, flag on the city hall of Budapest. And Elud Novak, who is the sort of deputy leader of Mihozank after Toretsky, went up there one night with a ladder and tore it off the building. He was immediately arrested.
I remember reading that. It was an inspiring interview. I think you did it with him. You did the interview with Novak.
No, I've never interviewed Novak. I did do an interview with Toretsky for Countercurrents, but that was before this incident. Okay. So no, I didn't do anything. You might be thinking there was an interview with Béla Ince when there was a Black Lives Matter statue that was put up, a small one, in one of the districts of Budapest, and he destroyed it less than a day after it went up. But he's not part of Mihozank. He's the leader of a group called Legio Ungaria, which is, I don't think they would think it was unfair to call them a skinhead movement in Hungary, but they're not affiliated with any party. They're more of an activist group.
I'm sorry, we got sidetracked. So yeah, that is the kind of movement we are dealing with here. And it's what's interesting to me is that the Florida law is not, it's actually very mild. People were joking around that, oh, you got to wait for children to be 12 before you teach them about homosexuality, is essentially what it says. But it is very mild, but liberals all over the place, these communists, these socialist types. And when Hungary passed its law in, was it 2019 or 2020? I forget.
The law was passed last year, so 2021.
Last year, right. I remember I was speaking to to a friend who is like you know, lived in Hungary at the time. It's like, this is just basic protection of children from undue, like, you wouldn't want children hearing about heterosexual sex either at this age, especially not to teach it at school. But people are pretending like this is a new pogrom against homosexuals or whatever. No, I mean, it's very mild, it's very basic, but the enemy, the left, there's such hysteria against this don't say gay thing. They're pretending like they're being hunted down by right-wing death squads. But do continue.
Oh yeah, you heard the same from some of the liberals in Budapest, of which unfortunately there are many at the time this came out. But the connection to Mihozank is that after Novak did this, it was very popular with the Hungarian public, as polls showed, and Fidesz took note of this. And they never actually came forward and endorsed what he did, since it was illegal, but plus they don't want to give any credit to any other party. But it was right after that they started making an issue out of this family protection. And that culminated in the law last spring. So you could say that already Mihozank is having an effect on Fidesz in terms of pulling them further to the right, which is what Jobbik used to do when they were actually a right-wing party. So that I think that bodes well that they'll hopefully continue to do things like this going forward.
This is very interesting because it shows a path for success for nationalists in the West. You know, maybe we never seize power and implement our policy, but we pose enough of a danger, politically speaking, that center-right parties such as Fidesz, right, or the Republican Party in America, or, I can't believe I'm saying this, the Tories in the United Kingdom, actually start implementing some of our policy proposals But the question remains is, you've read my article on the Nuremberg moral paradigm is, what we have witnessed in America and in the United Kingdom and in France and everywhere in Western Europe, right, is the willingness of the center-right to lose repeatedly so that it can avoid being labeled Nazi and racist and chauvinist and homophobic and all of those words, right? I think that there is a sort of an absorbing barrier for how far right the center-right parties can move before they start grandstanding on principle. And I think that the absorbing barrier really is the Nuremberg moral paradigm. So in the Hungarian example, I'm not sure Fidesz could ever come to terms with the reality of the gypsy question, which I do not doubt is very, very bad. Because we, like I said, we have gypsies here in Macedonia. They're all over the Balkans, and they're not a pleasant people to live next to. I will. That's all I'm going to say, right? I'm not sure that this path, the path of influencing the center right, even through adverse influencing, like Michał Zank is doing in Hungary, is viable. What is your opinion on that? Or is Hungary different? Because I've heard from some people that Hungary could be different, that Hungarians just don't care about being called racist.
Oh, there's some truth to that, but at the same time, Fidesz wants to be respected by, you know, internationally by Western European governments. So, I mean, by Western European and American standards, Orban and Fidesz are unimaginable, but really they're only what sensible conservatives in Western Europe and the American rights would have been endorsing 50 years ago. It's just an indication of how far to the left the West has gone, but they're not really radical in any real sense. They only seem that way in comparison to, you know, what is the norm in the West these days. So no, they're never gonna. Orban is very careful in what he does. You have to live here for a while to really see where it is, but there's a line he will not cross. He's very careful to not do anything that would endanger Hungary's position in the EU, in NATO, you know, all these other institutions that Hungary is dependent on right now. They always make a big deal out of the fact that they're, you know, supposedly warriors against the EU, against Brussels. But in reality, I think that's more mostly just rhetoric. They will challenge the EU on things where they know that they're only going to be called racist or gender phobes or, you know, trans phobes, whatever. But not anything that's going to actually cause real problems for them. Like right now, the EU is threatening to withhold some of the funds, not just for Hungary, but also for Poland, which is also seen as a problem state within the EU. And Poland is already indicating that they're going to cuck on some things in order to get this money. Hungary hasn't said anything about that yet, so it'll be curious to see how this develops. But yeah, I'm wondering if they might not be forced to pull back slightly. I mean, I would still much rather have Orban and Fidesz in power than any of the opposition apart from Michał Zank. But we have to be realistic about them. And the fact is, they're not really, you know, the idea that Orban is saving Europe, saving Western civilization, saving Hungary, that's really not true. At best, he's slowing down some of the trends that are destroying mm-hmm. Hungary. But the fact is that if you come here, Hungary is actually much closer to Western Europe than many countries further to the east that I've been to, for example. And part of that is geography and the fact that there's a lot of foreigners coming here now, but also it's just the fact that most Hungarians under the age of 50 or 60, whatever, have a Western propaganda device in their pockets 24/7. And they're, you know, whatever laws Orban passes, they're still getting all of this Western propaganda metapolitical subversion, they're willingly getting it through their communications devices. And it would be very difficult for a government to stop that, even if they wanted to, which, like I said, that's not something you would ever see Orban do. So I have to admit,
this is a major problem, not just for a country like Hungary, but Russia and China have a problem with the fact that the youth and the educated people are basically, they have this propaganda device in their pocket. They're connected 24/7 to what we can only realistically describe as propaganda outlets. Twitter is an American or Western propaganda outlet. Let's not fool ourselves about it. I believe last show with Vox Populi, I flat out called it a counterintelligence psyop. Something's going on over there. Something quite like MK Ultra is going on over there. I'm 100% certain that Twitter and Facebook and Insta, and especially, platforms like Instagram and TikTok, maybe in part intentionally designed to disrupt the psyche of people, right? And make them more pliable, make them more likely to follow certain instructions or to move in a certain way. And maybe this is not just by directly feeding propaganda, but by inciting people to behavior which would have been unimaginable to our ancestors. So, for example, I hate Instagram. It's no secret. Everyone I know and that knows me knows I absolutely despise Instagram. I think it unleashes the worst of female sexual instincts, the instincts to, whore yourself. Basically, I think it's not allowed to show your tits on Instagram, but everything but your tits, you show that. And this is a very toxic instinct that all women have, and we have more moral codes, religion, and older women disciplining younger women to stop this instinct from reigning, this libidinous instinct, this exhibitionist instinct of women. But I think that Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, they unlock these instincts. Like, the devil does not brainwash you. He does not tell you what to do. He allows you to do what your base instincts urge you to do. What we had, yes, religion and morality to keep in control. I think this is the methodology. And countries much bigger, much more powerful than Hungary, countries like Russia, countries like China, cannot get a handle on this. I mean, I don't think it's fair to put Orban on the spot. You cannot stop Instagram,
No, as I wrote in my article, I said that it's unfortunate that there are certain issues, certain limits that Orban won't go beyond. But at the same time, the alternative would be to turn Hungary into something like a conservative North Korea, because they would essentially, to really stop all of these trends, they would have to basically shut themselves off from the rest of the world. And quite honestly, even if he did that, I don't believe that he wants to do that, but even if he did, they would be voted out in the next election, because of course the average Hungarian is just like anyone you would meet in the US or Western Europe. I mean, they want to be materially successful. They want their children to have more opportunities, and most of them are not willing to sacrifice that in the name of national identity or conservative values or whatever. So my only hope is that Hungary continues to develop on its own unique course and doesn't fully get subsumed into the global homo, as I like to call it. Well, I'm not the only one, but we can hope that they...
It is a very popular term. Yeah.
Yes. And for me, the hope is not so much in the politics of Hungary, although it is interesting, but it's in the people of Hungary, because of course there are liberals here too, Western style liberals. They're still in the minority, but there's certainly a growing number of them among young people, especially the educated young people, and that's a problem. But at least as of now, most Hungarians you meet still are just have an innate sort of conservative outlook. And that's what gives me hope And that's what makes living here nice. It's that more than the fact that I have confidence that Fidesz is going to protect the country or something like that. So, yeah, that's for me the great hope, the Hungarian people more than the politics.
Well, that's a very interesting perspective. And, because I have my Hungary expert here, I want to ask you about Jobbik. In 2015, like you said, Jobbik started to court the liberals, right? And they've managed to court the liberals into their own obsolescence. Like, people, from what I understand, voted for Jobbik because Fidesz is a bunch of center-right cucks, right? So they saw...
Well, that was what was it initially. That wasn't... Right. When they were a right-wing party, that was the reason people supported them, was that they were presenting, allegedly, a more genuine right-wing alternative. And when I first came to Hungary, which was 8 years ago now, that hadn't ended yet. And they did have many very interesting positions. Like, it's not very well known outside of Hungary, but the Jobbik leadership was even very into a traditionalism, you know, Évalok and all these kinds of things. But that all ended shortly after I got here, when they decided to take this new route. But I couldn't even really tell you what they stand for today. And I've even asked people who I've met who said they were going to vote for Jobbik in the last election, why? And really all you can get from them is that because they, you know, anything is better than Orban. But I don't really know what they stand for these days other than that, just being against Orban. But their strategy didn't even really work. It worked somewhat in 2018 because they, you know, held their own. But it obviously completely failed this time because they lost half their support. I think ended up with like something like 8% of the vote. That's down from, I mean, in early 2015, just before they made the shift away from being a right-wing party, they were, some polls showed them having 30% support. So that's a big drop-off. So we can say they tried this and it didn't even work. They went to all this trouble.
My question is, right, because we've seen something similar in the West. Of course, it's on a much smaller scale. We see Jobbik, who are Evolian traditionalists, all of this, and they turn to the left. You know, they try to start courting the social democratic. And then you have people like Richard Spencer in the West. Right, so he's basically Mr. White Nationalism in America in the 2015-2016 period, and now he's endorsing Joe Biden. Now he's endorsing Emmanuel Macron. All of these enemies of the right, all of these enemies of white people, and so I need. Do you think that there may be something like a common mistake that the Jobbik leadership and Spencer share? In the sense that they lose sight of what's really important. They lose sight of why we're doing this. I mean, I do this because I want white people to survive. I want to help our people survive, really. At this point, I would be happy with that. People have accused Richard Spencer of being just a contrarian, that he just runs counter to whatever the center-right does. And don't get me wrong, if I saw the center-right on fire, I wouldn't piss on them. But you think there is something there that could be a common driver of these behaviors?
Well, superficially, yes, but the situation in Hungary is so different because in the U.S., the right courts liberals because they're in power. I mean, they control the levers of you know, institutions at all levels. That's not true in Hungary yet. The liberalism that you find here is mostly coming in from outside, but the center right, you could call it, very firmly controls all the major institutions in Hungary, or most of them anyway, maybe not some of the universities. But so it's not so much that the Jobbik was trying to kiss the master's ass as it is when rightists try to court the left. It was more just a very cynical strategy to get votes. And I don't even know that. I think what it showed was that they're hollow. I think that they wanted power more than there was any principle behind what they were doing. I mean, the people who are Jobbik members today are a completely different bunch from who were the members 10 years ago. There's no question about that. But I don't even know. I think even most liberal voters, the reason they did so poorly in this election was because most liberal voters recognize what I did, which is that they don't really believe in anything. Right. Because, I mean, this was the party that about 10 years ago, Martin Jingyashi, who's the sort of the deputy leader of Jobbik, he was then and he still is today, said that there needed to be a list of Jewish MPs in the Hungarian parliament that was published because people should know that these people might have dual loyalties. I mean, they went from that to now. I mean, they're working with
very rational proposals.
They're literally being funded by George Soros, copying all the same rhetoric as these people. There's an article, not by me, but written by a friend of mine that we published at Countercurrents called Jobbik History of a Political 180. And he shows through specific cases how they literally went from to saying the opposite of what they had originally said as a right-wing party when they started to undergo this shift. And that article was written a few years ago now. If it was written today, you could find even more egregious examples of them. But they literally became the, or tried to become the opposite of what they were originally. But it, I mean, as far as in the West, yeah, I mean, okay, you can say that was a silly strategy. But it's not quite the same situation just because, like I said, you're not here trying to ingratiate yourself with people who are in power. The liberals don't have any power in Hungary to any significant degree. So I think it was more just trying to court voters. But I have a Hungarian journalist friend, and I remember when years ago when Jobbik, we were discussing after the 2018 election, and she said to me that she couldn't really understand what they were thinking, because she said, well, they wanted to unite the radical right with the liberal left, Western style liberals in Hungary. But she said that's maybe 10% of the whole population. So she couldn't understand what they were thinking, that they thought that this would give them victory somehow. But that was what they tried.
If I was in their position, I would try to radicalize the center right voters, right?
Which is what they used to do. Yeah,
which is basically you sit down with a guy, he votes for the center right, like he votes for the Republican Party, and you ask him, what are you getting out of this? He says, well, not much, but they're not the left. How about if you vote for me, you actually get some of this? How about you actually see a crackdown on crime? You see a rollback of the woke agenda? You see immigration restrictions? It's get the guy thinking that these things are possible, that there are people in the political spectrum. And this is what Jobbik had and threw away, which is why I'm so baffled. It's not even... Maybe they just wanted to seize power now. Because what I'm proposing, it could take maybe 10, 20 years before you see actual tangible results. But you got to put those ideas out there. If those ideas are out there, they are, the worm is in people's heads that are thinking, okay, maybe we can get this. Maybe if enough people, and slowly, slowly you draw the electorate to the right. And they did. I mean, Jobbik had such institutional power in Hungary. Now they're nobodies. Now they have completely destroyed their brand. I can only hope that the far right in Hungary can be salvaged through Mihazang. But I think that's enough about Hungarian politics. I think we have well and truly exhausted the subject. Well, not perhaps fully.
Oh, not at all. But I mean, I think we actually want to discuss other things tonight. So
we do. I am fascinated, because to me, the politics of these Central European nations like Poland, like Hungary, they give me a ray of hope that, maybe not everything is lost everywhere.
If you want to have me on sometime just to talk about that, I'd be happy to do that. That could be a show in itself.
That could be arranged. I know you enjoy these chinwags. Or maybe we could just talk about movies. I hear you're good at that. We've been having donations. We've been receiving donations and people. Countercurrents is having a fundraiser, which means we are raising funds. I know. It's not very original, but we do need money to keep the lights on here. We do need money to keep me smothered in fungal tea. We do need money for all sorts of reasons. Money is what makes white nationalism possible. And you can donate to us through Entropy. I see our mods have already put the Entropy link in the chat, and you can also use Cash App to donate money. And you can, of course, pose questions to us through Entropy. Post questions to me, post questions to John. He's a very wise guy. He's not just movies and Hungary guy. Here, he was also Hare Krishna at one point. That must have been very interesting. So, what do we have next? We are also discussing other articles. I actually have seven here. Let's see. Implications of the Fall of Communism in Europe by Dominique Venner. Now, Dominique Venner is one of the French New Right figures, if I'm not mistaken. And
He was
he was.
affiliated with them, but he wasn't exactly part of their school. In the
This is
70s, he worked with them
interesting.
for a time, but he was kind of on his own. He didn't really adhere to any particular school.
And this is actually an extract from Les Carnets Rebelles, the Rebels' Notebooks, which have hitherto not been published. And it dates from the 90s, right? And this is
Early
basically
90s.
early 90s, yes, maybe even 1991 or 1990, which means that this is maybe the first time on the writer's block where we have discussed an article older than the host. It is about the post-communist world. Now, if it is indeed from 1999, I will be even more impressed because people have been talking about the communist world, about the second world, the world behind the Iron Curtain, not just Russia, of course, not just the Soviet Union, but also Yugoslavia, Hungary, Poland, Czech Republic, all of these places which were under the heavy boot of Soviet and Warsaw Pact oppression. Yet this guy, Dominique Venner greatly understands the nature of the anti-Soviet revolutions in this early period. Something that dovetails nicely with what you said about Hungary. What's interesting to me is that at the very early date, he understands that the East is not the West, does not share the West's ideology, the West's liberal disposition, that in many ways the reactions in Eastern Europe are not so much against communism, but a nationalist reaction again of these nations, and especially maybe the nations of the Visegrad group, against their life in Russian subjugation or Soviet subjugation. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean it dovetails very well because Orban first emerged as an he was like the first of the major opposition figures that emerged in the late 1980s as the communist system was crumbling. In fact, the way he first made a name for himself was by giving a speech on Majalis, May 1st, which is a big holiday in Hungary today, in
That's
which he
today.
called Russian troops to be withdrawn from the country, which was already going to happen anyway. I mean, the Soviet Empire was crumbling, but that was yeah, that was how he got his start. And Fidesz initially was more of like they always called themselves conservative, but they used to be much more trying to imitate Western liberals. And in fact, Orban's first term as prime minister was from 1998 to 2002. And he basically tried to copy the Western European, especially German, Christian democratic model. And he was voted out after one term. And the analysis that I've read about this from Hungarian commentators is that they think that he just figured out that, well, you can't just copy Western European politics in Hungary. You have to develop unique doctrine and style specifically for Hungary. And that's what he did. And that's how they've ended up becoming, quote unquote, more radical than conservatives in Western Europe or America today. Although, again, I caution against seeing them as radicals. They're not. Yeah, and you see this all over Eastern Europe, in some countries more than others. Poland, with its Law and Justice Party, the ruling party there, similar populist right party to Orban's. It's been ruling for, I believe, about 7 years now. And you see a similar style of politics all over Eastern Europe. The Visegrad group at the moment is in trouble, though, because Slovenia and the Czech Republic are now in the hands of liberal governments that are not on board with everything that Hungary and Poland are doing. They were until quite recently, so it's not really that much of a unified bloc. Plus, the Russia issue is dividing them now, because Hungary has taken a very strongly neutral stance on the war, whereas, of course, Poland is probably the most active country, certainly in the EU, in supporting Ukraine. So this has become a bone of contention there. So we'll see. Maybe the Visegrad group will become something again in the future. But for the moment, it's kind of in trouble. But it is a unique blend here that you see anti-liberalism. Although I would argue that Orban famously once described his ideology as illiberal democracy, but they're not actually opponents of democracy. I think more what he meant was that they're classical liberals. They're what they're against the form of liberalism that exists in Western Europe today, but they're more what liberals would have been, say, 50 years ago. So I think that's more what he's getting at. But there's also elements in what Fidesz does that would be called socialist in the U.S. I mean, people here are not afraid of big governments like conservatives in the U.S. and the U.K. are. Here, that's just considered part of what a government does. So, like, for example, I know Fidesz has some work programs in areas that have been especially hard hit economically. They actually create work programs for people to go, and you know, so they have something to do, often like making cheese or these sorts of things. You would never hear of something like that in the U.S. from Republicans. That would be unimaginable. So
no, that's actually a Democrat style program, right?
Yeah,
FDR exactly. Used to do things like that.
So you could say that, yeah, you see a very unique form of the right that's risen here. So Van Ure was quite prescient in seeing that development. I mean, in that essay, it's obvious he was writing it while the Soviet Union still existed. So it must have been 90 or 91.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah, and that's
so it's definitely older than me, because I was born after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So yeah, that's a first on the writer's block. Read an essay older than the host. But you know what they say: literature ages like fine wine. Men age like biological creatures, which is to say, we become decrepit and senile with age. We lose we lose our trail of thoughts. We disappear from the stream for activities. It is what it is, I guess. It is what it is. What's interesting to me is that I think about this. I read this article. I read of a nationalistic reaction to the Russian presence. But I think about the Czech Republic, right? The Czechs are the exception, maybe, to this rule, because if I remember correctly, Václav Havel becomes president of Czechoslovakia and then the Czech Republic in the Velvet Divorce. And he hires Frank Zappa as a cultural advisor. And the Czechs really seem to be the outlier of Central Europe, the outlier of the Visegrad group, that these people really are significantly more Western, you could say, than the Polish, than the Hungarians, or the Slovaks. There is very little Czech nationalism, as there is loud and powerful displays of Polish and Hungarian nationalism.
Yes.
Certainly, I mean, compared to us in the Balkans, right? The Czechs are basically English, basically German. Would you like to speculate about that? I mean, we could. There is no way to address this without addressing the significant German admixture of Czechs. But what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's definitely true. That the Czech government is not on board with everything that Hungary and Poland are doing. But I think more generally, what happened in the Eastern Bloc was, and this is why Benur, I think it's shows what a wise man he was, that he foresaw all this, was that I think the assumption in the 90s and into the 2000s was that Eastern Europe was just going to basically become a copy of Western Europe, become westernized overnight, and that everything would be great. But what the optimists didn't anticipate in that period was that Western Europe didn't so much integrate with Eastern Europe as much as colonize it. And the Western European nations, most especially Germany, but not exclusively Germany, gain a lot by the cheap labor that they can derive both from Hungarian immigrants. And for example, Germany has many of its auto factories in Hungary. In fact, the Hungarian economy is dependent on them. So in that sense, people started to realize over time that, well, gee, we're all allegedly one block now. We're all allegedly equally valuable, yet we're still living in a materially worse circumstances than our Western brothers. And I think people slowly woke up to the fact that they weren't really seen as equals, and that the, if you want to call it the EU dream, similar to the American dream, was not about to explode into every household in Eastern Europe. There was a lot of disillusionment, and I think that's why you have seen things like Law and Justice in Poland, Fidesz in Hungary, and so on, because people suddenly realized that, oh, maybe the answer isn't just to go along with everything the West wants to do. Now, my worry, however, is that as long as they are part of the EU, and as long as everyone's carrying around Western propaganda devices in their pockets in the form of their phones, that the young people are still going to be brainwashed into thinking that this is the way to go. But only time will tell which of these trends will win out, or maybe they'll somehow synthesize. It's unclear now. But Venur clearly understood everything that was going to happen right off the bat. So that's something else to his credit, I would say. I'll just mention one last thing. The Visegrad group was not originally intended as like an alternate EU, as it's sometimes depicted today. Its sole goal was to get the four Visegrad group members into the EU, which of course was fulfilled in 2004. And then it kind of languished for about a decade. And then in the mid 2010s, when they all had populist conservative governments, they decided, well, maybe we could be like an illiberal alternative to the EU. But the future of that project is unclear now, given the political circumstances I outlined before. So we'll just have to see what happens.
On this show, when discussing George Grant's Lament for a Nation, what was very interesting to me was that George Grant pointed out that Canada's political subjugation to America was preceded by economic integration of central Canada, so of Ontario and Quebec, so Toronto and Montreal, essentially, into the American Great Lakes region. Now, I know you have some connection with Michigan, so you might understand this thing, but they did have this situation where the American auto industry, the car is not, it may be assembled in a single place, but the various car parts are manufactured on both sides of the border. And when the trucker convoy, for example, blockaded the Ambassador Bridge in London, Ontario, between America and Canada, something like 20% of the trade between America and Canada was disrupted. And a lot of this trade is just auto parts crisscrossing the border to be assembled into. So basically, you have a factory for half-finished products in America. They move to Canada. They assemble a car part, like, for example, the engine, and then they bring the engine over to America to put it in a finished car, right? Mm-hmm. And a similar situation is going on all over Eastern Europe with regard to basically the German automobile industry. I know guys who cut cables, you know, so automotive cable, transmission cables are produced in Macedonia. A lot of the, it's not cars, German cars being made in Hungary and all over Eastern Europe, it's German car parts. These cars are ultimately assembled in Germany, right? So they can claim that the car is made in Germany. It's actually made, its constituents parts are made in Eastern Europe a lot of times from materials mined in Germany. So basically, before the thing becomes a car, it has traveled the length and breadth of Europe. And it's very hard to disentangle Hungary and Poland and even a country as far away as Macedonia from the German economy. And this gives Germany and the EU and the America, which has Germany's balls under lock and key in a vault beneath the State Department in Washington, leverage over the entirety of Eastern Europe, the entire Visegrad group, which is similar to the leverage that America has over Canada. So I'm not sure to what extent the Visegrad countries or other Eastern European countries can buck the trend, cast off the yoke of Western imperialism, of global homo, without seriously endangering their economies. The degree of Western economic integration between Germany and these countries is just too great. Something they and we in Macedonia, we brought on over ourselves. I remember in the 90s and 2000s, everyone was saying, oh, we need foreign investment. That's the only way to get our economies moving. Well, it turns out that if all of the capital is foreign owned, the foreigners essentially own your country because they own its economic engine. They own the means by which people, you know, earn their living. And it's not a good position for a country to be in. So again, one factor is, of course, everyone has cell phones in their pockets. These demonic entities such as Instagram and TikTok and Twitter are, you know, gnawing away at people's souls. Another way, well, maybe less subtle, is direct economic control of these countries by Germany, by France, by the United Kingdom, by America. It is colonialism in a sense, right? There's also absolutely the fact that, yeah.
I mean, you'll see walking the streets of Budapest, I mean, the most common grocery stores you'll see are Aldi and Lidl, which are German.
Yeah.
And Spar, which I believe is Norwegian. There's one Hungarian one called CVA, but you hardly ever see them around anymore. So, yeah, and we, you know, like the most popular drugstores are Rossmann's and DM, which are both German. So, yeah, they have a pretty firm lock on this country. And that's why you're never going to wake up one day and see that Orban has said that, well, we're going to put all the gypsies into camps or kick them out of the country, because then suddenly all that German investment would dry up. But that's, at the same token, that's why when Hungary passes this LGBTQ law, the EU will not actually kick Hungary out, even though sometimes they may make threatening rhetoric about that, because the EU is Germany and Germany doesn't want to lose their cheap auto workers. So it's a game that they play. I mean, I don't want to pretend that there aren't any real issues at stake, but you shouldn't get taken in by the surface rhetoric, because it's not always what it seems. But like we were saying before when we were discussing the election, we can't really be too hard on Orban for this, because the alternative is the North Korean option. And I don't think that's what the average Hungarian wants, to be isolated from the rest of the world. So it's a difficult balance to strike, and maybe they're doing as much as they can under the circumstances. That's debatable, but that's the reality of the situation.
It is. Yeah, people have been pointing out, and I agree with them, that Orban is essentially, it doesn't matter what his opinion of Russia is or Ukraine or the situation is, He is bound by material reality, which is the economic integration of Hungary and Russia to remain neutral in this conflict, you know, strongly neutral. He is also bound by this same material reality, his integration with the German industrial might, the German auto industry in all these places, to remain within the European Union. No matter how much we as nationalists, we dislike the European Union as an entity, it's a choice that these Eastern European countries have made. Now we have to live with it. Maybe we find ways to disintegrate ourselves, to maybe extricate ourselves from these economic entanglements, but this is something for the future. And of course, the majority opinion in Central and Eastern Europe is that no, we need more integration with the West, economically speaking. People might be ready to extricate themselves from economic integration with Russia and other countries of the East, but to a lot of people in Eastern Europe, the West is the place where, you know, the streets are paved with gold. And people go to the West. They get, I think over time, as the cities of the West are taken over by the diversity and become less and less livable, maybe. But the image of, let's not forget, I remember reading like 100 years ago about people in Romania watching Dallas or Dynasty. Yeah, people in Yugoslavia watch Dynasty. In Romania, they watch Dallas, which is an American soap opera. And to
watched Dallas in my parents' house when I was a kid.
Yeah, to people, to a lot of people in the East, especially the poor and the lower middle class who don't really have enough money to travel, the West is basically what they saw in these 80s and early 90s television, right? Oh, yeah. Whereas, you know, when I went to Paris in 2012, it was such a massive shock to see that it was dirtier than the East, that it was obviously a beautiful city which is in the process of falling apart, maybe in the early stages of falling apart. This was 2012. Now it's 10 years later, and it's much worse over there. It's something to think about.
Yeah, it's. I don't know that I would say that people, most people anyway, in Hungary, I mean, it's different for each country, of course, but want more integration, but they don't want to end integration, I would say, because I was speaking with László Toretzky, the leader of Mihozánk, once years ago, and somebody else brought up the issue that, well, Hungary should just withdraw from the EU altogether. And he pointed out that, well, even if we did that, Hungary would be poorer than Bulgaria overnight. And he said, besides which, we would have to make trade agreements with all the EU countries anyway, so they would still have a hold over us. So it's complicated. It's not so easy to extricate yourself. But I did want to make just one brief comment, because you were mentioning Orban's position on Russia and Ukraine and so forth. The key to understanding Hungary is, and Orban is very typically Hungarian in this regard, he tries to get along with everybody. So he's trying to get along simultaneously with the US, China, Russia, Turkey. He used to try to get along with Ukraine. That's kind of off the table for the moment. But he doesn't make ideological decisions, and Hungarians don't even want to make ideological decisions, because they understand that they're poor and a weak country. They have a small economy and they don't have any military significance. So they know that they can't be the one wearing the pants geopolitically. So they just try to maximize things for their own advantage and their relationships. But you shouldn't take it that because Orban's declaring neutrality in the war, that means that therefore he loves Putin and Russia and Hungarians love Russia. It's just because that they see that it's in their interest to do that, but it's not an ideological decision. So that's something important to think about when you're looking at what Hungary is doing. And they've always been this way in their history. They've always been this way.
It is, how do I put this, refreshing to see non-ideological decisions in government. We have become used in the West to nothing but ideological decisions, right? Especially in America and the United Kingdom. These countries are have become so hyper-ideological that when you take a dump for ending oppression of blacks or whatever.
Yeah, but they're
I'm sure that when this
powers, so they set the stage, and countries like Hungary just have to play along. So it's, I mean, we're not ideological in American politics today, unfortunately. But if the true right is ever going to make any difference there, of course, we'll have to be ideological. But that's why we're out of step with these times. But that's a whole other discussion. I don't want to get into that right now. But
right. Anyways, so I think that that's Mr. Venner's insights, well, taken into account. I invite everyone to actually read the article. It's very brief. It's one of the briefest that's ever been discussed on the writer's block. And that's another thing, right? Sometimes you read the long 6,000 words ones. When I was working in an office, I would brew myself a big pot of coffee and just enjoy myself on my break. And sometimes you read the you can actually read through this quickly, but you need a long time to think about it. That's something to take into consideration about Eastern Europe in general. In the 90s, right, the West made the mistake of thinking, yeah, this is an ideological, these are ideological movements. They're really about casting off communism and embracing liberalism, whereas the dimension was always more get the Russians out, get the Soviet Union out, we want to be independent. These were nationalist movements. And of course, the reaction from the East was, oh, these people have turned to fascism again. This was something you heard about Croatia. It's something you hear about Ukraine today, that the Ukrainian nationalism is inseparable from fascism. I remember this very vividly. Older people here in Macedonia, right, in Yugoslavia, they have violent reactions to the idea of Croatian nationalism. It's to them, it's cannot be separated out from fascism. But you think beyond the whole Ustasha thing. No, Croatian nationalism was always about let's have a Croatia for Croatians. I think something similar is going on in Ukraine right now, went on in Poland. And even Poland today, Poland's, you could say, extreme stance towards Russia is about we never want to see Russian tanks in Poland ever again. We're ready to set the world on fire over this question. It is admirable. The intensity of it is admirable. The sanity is quite, I don't know. Let's not get into that. But it's something to consider that for the stance of Central and Eastern European country is less ideological and more get these occupiers out. We'll think about everything else later. Mm-hmm. But we can move on to the next article. We can move on. Let's see, which would we have been talking about the future. So we have, let's keep things European, by Asier Abardoa. A new invasion of Spain demands a new Reconquista. Well, what Asier Abardoa is telling us the situation as it stands in Spain. Now, Spain is a frontier country of the European continent. It's, you know, on the Mediterranean. There's Morocco is just there. And it did not see a lot of migration in the 2015-16 period during this migrant crisis, but it is now the preferred destination. And it became really, I think, when Salvini shut down the Italian coast, and now it's basically being taken over by migrants. It is being invaded, more or less. And of course, Spain has its own native gypsy problem, which never really went away. The Arabs brought the gypsies into Spain. They have turned certain portions of Valencia into crime-ridden, drug-ridden ghettos where normal people just don't go. It is horrible. Spain is one of the great civilizations of the West. Possibly the eldest civilization of the West, you could say. But what are your thoughts about this, John?
Well, I like the beginning of the article because he talked about a lot of things that I hadn't known. I haven't really read a lot about contemporary Spain. So especially this event in 2000 that he mentioned, where the citizens of a town that was undergoing a lot of immigrant crime sort of rose up and took matters into their own hands. I'd never heard of that. So that was interesting. But I would have preferred if he could have gotten a bit more specific about what the Reconquista would look like. Because, I mean, it's one thing to say that, but I'm never clear on what people mean when they say that we need to do this, because it's like, what, is it voting for Vox? Or you know, is it something more grassroots, more direct? I mean, I in part because of living in Hungary, I've grown a bit more pessimistic about populism. I mean, I support right-wing populists because, of course, that's the best political game that's going in the mainstream. But it should be obvious to all of us by now, after all these years of seeing populism in action, that it's completely inadequate to deal with the problems we're facing. So I don't think the solution, you know, I don't think the Reconquista is going to come in the form of voting in some populist right political party and then letting them handle things. But I also don't know. I don't know what it would look like in Spain or anywhere else for that matter. Because we would have to be able to organize sufficient resources and numbers of people to actually do it. And plus you would have, especially in Western Europe, all the institutions of culture and government working against you. So I don't know. I agree that's what we need, but I'd be curious to know this writer who I don't know personally. I'd be curious to know more about how he thinks this could happen.
The interesting thing is, right, it's, we're back to what is Micha Zank proposing to do with the gypsies, right? I asked you this question, what if, let's say, Micha Zank is in power in Hungary, right? 100% of all the deputies in the national parliament, what do they do with the gypsies? What do they do about the gypsy problem? It's the similar category of questions. If you ask, if you answer it, or even ask it with any seriousness, you are violating the Nuremberg moral paradigm, right? You are violating this notion that this prohibition on nations thinking of themselves as nations, especially white nations, right? Spain, being a white nation, if it's going to, you know, have a reconquista against the migrants and against the gypsies, which this article also mentions, right, is going to have to, it's going to have to expel people. So that's the interesting thing.
But then America might just decide to bring you some democracy, right?
Right.
I mean, that's always the joke that I have with my Hungarian friends, that if we actually, you know, tried to do something about the gypsy problem or whatever, then yeah, America would bring us some democracy. That's the one.
America would bomb Budapest and destroy all of the liberal hipsters, which...
Wait, oh no, they probably all go thing? Out to, they probably all run to Austria or something. Yeah. But yeah.
Again, you're trying to discourage people from doing this. It is, it's something to think about. Yeah. But yeah, to even, so we're not just talking about here, the populists thought they could, you know, do a gotcha on the left by saying, oh, we're against illegal immigration. But, you know, so yeah, many people are immigrating here legally. They're being given, you know, asylum. And like we said, the problem with gypsies, again, in Spain, in Hungary, in Macedonia, in Bulgaria, in Romania, it's not, they immigrated 1,200 years ago, right? They are citizens. They, what are you going to do about these people?
It's, yeah, it's not the same as the problem with blacks in the U.S. I mean, obviously, again, that's not an immigration problem because they've been there for hundreds of years. So it's a different sort of problem. And yeah, it's, I mean, you can have the communitarian solution where you just have like various parts of the country cordoned off for certain people, or you simply expel them, or, you know, then the question becomes, where do they go? So
yeah, and they tried that in South Africa, and we know how the global power elite reacted to that. And of course, even in South Africa, it was simply not a viable solution, because birth rates would have meant the blacks would have simply overwhelmed the white minority of South Africa in a couple of generations anyway. I mean, when people ask me, did I support apartheid in South Africa? I say, no, I opposed it because it's a half measure. I don't believe in half measures. So even something as radical from this standpoint as South African apartheid is simply a half measure. Now, of course, Hungarians and Spanish are not as outnumbered as the Boers were in South Africa in the 90s, but it's still this is a question of time. When you see, you compare fertility rates of gypsies with normal Europeans or immigrants or blacks or Arabs or whatever, you're seeing a completely unsustainable, untenable situation, right? So this is something to think about.
It was interesting because when Trump was president in before the midterm elections in 2018, this was totally buried in the second half of his presidency. But he actually called for an end to birthright citizenship. And that was one of the few times after early 2017 I actually got enthusiastic about Trump. But of course, it was just an election ploy. And after the midterms passed, you never heard it ever mentioned again. But that is, of course, the sort of thing that would need to happen to affect these sorts of changes. But we're not going to see that from conservatives.
I think that the United States is one of the very few countries which practices birthright citizenship, jus soli, as we used to call it in law school. And it's something very interesting. If a pregnant, and I hear people do this, pregnant women get on a plane to America, give birth in America, and the child immediately gets a U.S. citizenship.
Yeah, maybe in a deportation cell, or some sort of holding room. Yeah, they give birth there, and then
rich,
the kid is American.
Rich, rich Chinese, rich Russians, rich Arabs, they do this, right? They put their pregnant wives on planes, so the children will be born as American citizens.
Not only the rich ones, it's also the poor ones. The border, the fence hoppers on the southern border.
Yeah, it is one of these. So these are not just questions you can answer by saying, "Oh, I'm against illegal immigration." No, you have to think about stopping legal immigration or putting serious limits on it, and actually stripping people off citizenship. Again, like America's problem, if America is going to bring its non-white population to manageable levels, it will have to strip significant, like many, many millions of, many tens of millions of people will have to be stripped of citizenship, deported, or basically just cordoned off, as you say, in an apartheid style solution, which again is not even if it were viable, it's not a permanent solution. Have we black-pilled people enough? Are you not entertained, watchers of the writer's block? We are, of course.
Well, I don't think people should be black-pilled, but we have to be realistic about the problems we face. And we definitely, I think it's important to keep reminding people that the solution is not going to come in the form of a conservative political party. I mean, these are things we're going to have to build ourselves. We can take sides in political debates in our own countries when we see that, like in Hungary, that one side is somewhat better on some issues than the other. But none of these are ultimately what's needed. We have to always be pushing for more complete, more radical solutions.
Yeah, it is. Of course, I personally cannot resist the scrap, just the electoral politics. I find it very exciting.
Some of my friends watch sports. I follow politics. That's how I. It's not that I'm expecting that the world is going to be saved, but it's entertaining.
It is like it's the thing, right? Sports, politics, video games, rooting for Russia or Ukraine in the war. It's an outlet for our masculine energies, which are just sorely lacking in an outlet. Maybe in a better world, we would have actually done something worthwhile with all of this excess testosterone, all of this. But it is what it is, I guess. I'm 30 years old. I've never killed a man. I'm not the kind of guy who likes to break the law. I prefer to do it legally. But the opportunities for proving my valor in battle are very slim indeed. It's one of those things, I guess. Don't we all suffer in this mortal coil? Hadrian was right, donating $5 and says, "Great stream, thanks." Well, that is a very eloquent praise. of this. You know, he's a man of few words. Hadrian was right, and Hadrian was indeed right. A massive wall must be erected between civilization and the Scots. I fully support the Emperor Hadrian on that and on some other measures he took about a certain people in the Middle East, but let's not talk about that. We are here to have fun on the Writer's Block. Nothing but wholesome Chungus conservatism over here. No, none of that nasty white nationalist stuff, I would say. What do we got else? What else do we have there? Anything else you want to say about the Reconquista article by Asier Abardoa? Well, he certainly has a sexy name, the man, Asier Abardoa.
Indeed. But I don't know. I mean, we've got a number of others to cover, so that's...
Now, speaking about Spain, the bulk of the migrants coming in to Spain would be Muslim, of the Muslim religion. And we got one here by Mark Gullick, which to me is very interesting. It's a review of The Closing of the Muslim Mind, How Intellectual Suicide Created the Modern Islamist Crisis. And it's a book from 2010 by Robert R. Riley, reviewed by Mark Gullick for countercurrents.com. And the book's thesis is very interesting. I think I read a review of this book back when it came out, that essentially the path which the Muslim religion took towards the end of Arabic civilization, the split between Mutazilites and Asharites, and of course the ultimate triumph of the Ashari school of Islam, is what closed, what the author calls the closing of the Muslim mind, essentially the rejection of predictability, of basically the scientific, the knowable nature of reality by Islam, and the embrace of occasionalism, this idea that if things happen, it's only because Allah wills it that they happen. It's not so, and it goes into just really basic thing, but like, why does water boil? Because we heat it? No, because Allah wills it, right? The book's thesis is that this degeneration of the Muslim faith is actually at the root of the threat that Islam poses to the modern world, to basically the West, and its incompatibility with the Western outlook. What would you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's been an interesting question, well, for Western, the average Westerner, for the last 20 years now, since Islam kind of got thrust into the spotlight as a result of 9/11, and then later, at least in Europe, because of immigration as well as terrorism. But I was grateful to Mark for writing this article, because it was something I had thought about, but I'd never actually taken the trouble to read up on it as he has. And I've even, you know, I used to live in Michigan, which has a large Muslim population. And I even talked to some Muslims when I was living there, and even they would bring up this subject about what went wrong with the Islamic world, because it's strange to think now that, you know, 1,000 years ago, 1,200 years ago, the Islamic world was leading in terms of philosophy and certain other aspects of technical development and so forth. But that's now of course, it's among the most backward regions of the world. So How did they get from A to B? That's a very interesting question. And of course, one we should be pondering, since we don't want to end up on the same path. Although I don't think this particular path to civilizational decline is one that we're facing in the West as a realistic possibility, but it's still interesting to analyze it. And I think this idea that fundamentalism breeds not just a lack of understanding, but also perhaps a laziness, an unwillingness to understand.
A hostility to understanding, maybe.
Yeah.
The very idea of understanding could be blasphemous to an Ashari mind.
This can only work though in a completely closed society, because when you exist alongside other civilizations that are in different paradigms, inevitably you're going to end up getting muscled out, which I think is what's in part been driving the Islamist movement in recent decades, because people are hungry to get back to the glory that was the ancient Islamic world. But I have to say, in some ways, similar to how rightists in the West try to contemplate where did things go wrong, they often don't get the question right, so, or they don't come to the right answers. So maybe that's why instead of actually trying to institute any real reforms in their societies, they mainly just end up putting people in body bags. It was interesting because if you look at Islamism in Iraq, which despite several attempts ultimately failed to take hold there over the last 20 years, you can see that the same thing already happened in Algeria in the 90s. An Islamist party actually won an election, I forget in what year, but it was in the early 90s, against the ruling sort of social nationalist party that had been in power since the since French colonialism had ended. And they became incredibly brutal and went around executing thousands of people for not following Sharia law, absolutely, basically alienated the entire populace, and then were gradually eliminated until they became insignificant as a political force. And this had all happened before 9/11. So the interesting thing is that the Islamist movement had already failed in one place, in Algeria, but actually gained a second life as a result of 9/11. But things are still playing out. We don't know how they're going to end. These things haven't gone away. But I think we can safely say now that Islamism isn't about to take over the world, or even the Islamic world. I mean, there has not been a debatably, you could argue the Taliban, but otherwise you cannot really point to a single successful Islamic fundamentalist
movement.
I think
the Taliban, they wear the clothes of Islam, but fundamentally this is an occupiers out of our country type movement. Yes, in the theoretical, they are about Islam dominating the world, but when they held power in the 90s, they did not really venture outside of Afghanistan. And I don't think they are going to venture outside of Afghanistan right now. It's
I agree. Absolutely.
I think the Afghan mind is specifically very insular. I don't think they think about what goes on outside of Afghanistan, except maybe what goes on in Pakistan a little bit. So, but yeah, I don't think the Taliban count.
Well, why I referred to them was just that they're an example of an Islamist group that actually has succeeded in coming to power twice, but I'm really hard pressed to think of anywhere else where that's been the case over the last 20 years. Despite their grandiose goals, the Islamists really haven't been successful in actually implementing them anywhere.
That's so interesting, because I have my own theory about the Asharism versus let me just get the name right. Mutazilism in Islam. I think that the Islamic faith, the Islamic or Arabic civilization, is a civilization which took Soren Kierkegaard's advice in its dying days. And so we are talking, of course, these debates are had in Baghdad during the, I believe, Abbasid caliphs, right? Just before the Crusades break the back of Islam and the Mongols clean up the rest. I think what happens is civilizations, they go through this cycle, right? The Spenglerian cycle, they lose their faith. And there are certain ways, things you can do as a civilization when you lose your faith. Søren Kierkegaard's advice for the West was make the leap of faith, believe despite the lack of evidence. And I think that Asharism, which is the belief that everything is the will of Allah, is a Kierkegaardian leap of faith, and I think that Islam took it on a civilizational level, or at least the Islamist Ashari movements and this Ashari school of thought really took it. I think that all religions are a metaphysical moral dipole. And I think that when religions start to die, attempts to revive them inflate one while shrinking the other pole. So Islam responded by intensifying the metaphysical, whereas the West rejects the metaphysic and embraces the ethical, the moral perspective of Christianity, right? And this is something you see if you look at the religion of, or what passes for a religion of the globalist elite. You could really call it Christianity without Christ, Christianity without the metaphysic. The basic moral order of Global Homo is Christian. It just has no metaphysical stopgap. Now, and
right.
I'm saying this as a Christian. I'm saying this as someone who actually believes in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And I think that if you stop believing in this, but retain the moral dimension of Christianity, you transform into the monster, which is modern liberal global homo, whatever you want to call it. I think that the West did not take Kierkegaard's advice, but went in the opposite direction, dropped the metaphysical, but fully embraced the moral. And you see the absolute faithless moral fervor of modern liberalism. That's my theory, at least.
Well, Nietzsche and Alain de Benoist would agree with you. That's their diagnosis of Western morality as well. So, yeah, so we see the other extreme in Islamism.
Yeah, but, it is a shame that these civilizations have to fall apart, but that is the fate. That is the fate of civilizations. That is all of our fate here in the mortal coil. And I'm just going to stop with the blackpilling because our legal team has informed us that this is horrible for fundraising morale. But we do serve the truth here on the writer's block, or at least we try to.
Well, yeah, I mean, we can say those countries are falling apart. The problem is they're still having lots of kids. So this is the this is the reason why there's still a problem. But
It is a very interesting. Nobody falls apart quite like the West. Although we should probably, we do not have reliable data on fertility rates during the end times of Arabic and Chinese civilizations. I'm pretty sure that they would have been very bad. Let's move on. Unless you have something to add on this subject. I think it's time to move on since we put Christianity on the spot. Let's move on to the interview which Mr. James O'Meara conducted with Dr. Robert Price, who is a prominent New Testament scholar and an Eldritch mage of the Lovecraft cult. Now, what's very interesting to me here is that Dr. Robert Price, who is being interviewed by James O'Meara, is a Bible scholar who does not consider the Bible to be true or the Word of God. He considers it, well, a work of fiction, which is still a very worthwhile work of fiction. It's got some good moral lessons. It's got some good metaphysical lessons. But this is a very interesting perspective. A Bible scholar who doesn't believe in God. What is your impression?
Well, that's not anything new. I mean, you could say, for example, Joseph Campbell, the way that he approached religion was to kind of not to see them as the ultimate truth, but rather as basically stories, but not stories in the same sense as like, you know, Tom Clancy or Daniel Steele or something of that nature, but stories that have deep truths embedded in our psyches. I'm not saying that I used Campbell for comparison, but I'm not saying that Mr. Jensen is of that school. He's clearly not. But I can't comment on his specific treatment of the New Testament because I don't know. Oh, I'm sorry. I said Jensen. I meant Dr. Price, of course.
Yeah.
I don't know enough about biblical studies to comment on that, but I found the parts of the interview where he was discussing the problems he's had politically as a Trump supporter As an evil conservative that actually seems to have caused him greater problems than the radicalism of some of his takes on the Bible.
Right. It is very interesting. And I think it dovetails very nicely with our discussion of the direction of the West. If we were still a Christian civilization, he would have been put through the ringer for his views on the Bible. I certainly found them disconcerting. Mm. But he's been put through the ringer for violating the moral truths, the absolute moral imperatives of our civilization, which are essentially the Nuremberg moral paradigm. There's some other older ones, but this is the main one. And he's not even violating them. As a Trump supporter, he's just hinting possibly in the direction of a violation of the Nuremberg moral paradigm. So this is something very interesting, that here's a guy who basically denies the divinity of Christ, that denies the truth of the Bible, but what he's being put through, he's being put through the ideological ringer for denying the evil of Donald Trump. That's that's maybe more important, but otherwise I find his views about on the Bible to be very much in line with Neville Goddard's position that the Bible is an instruction manual on how to unleash the potential of your own mind, which is a very interesting view on the Christian religion, certainly unorthodox, but it is Mr. O'Meara's favorite hobby horse, from what I understand.
Well, also at the end, I don't think James has written any articles in the last 7 years or so in which he doesn't work in New Thought somehow. He manages to get that in at the end. But it was interesting what Dr. Price said about that. And I think since we've been accused of being too black-pilling, you do have to always, of course, maintain a positive consciousness and an awareness of what it is, not only that you want to see in the world, but that you want to be in order to... That's how you become that, is by picturing yourself as something better. So yeah. I don't blame James for continuing to hammer that message home, because I think it's definitely an important one for the right, which does tend to be dominated by doom and gloom. Yeah. I don't exempt myself from that.
we are privileged. I'm also a reader of James O'Meara. He's been on this show two or three times. I forget how many, but it's... I don't think I have to read Neville Goddard. I can just read James O'Meara on Neville Goddard. It's one of those things which is very... And this sort of monomaniacal focus on one subject, it's the trait of people who could be called geniuses, right? So we might have a certifiable genius writing for Countercurrents. I don't know. I will... I'm too arrogant about my own intelligence to accurately assess the intelligence of other people. So someone else will have to make that judgment. I agree with you, yeah, that we are a doom and gloom type of people. I think that people who are not necessarily conservative, but people who are right-wing, especially like us, dissident rightists, hardcore rightists, we tend to have a negative view on people because we have this historical, maybe world historical view of things, because I always feel a slight melancholy when I think about the age of the place I find myself. Like, maybe this is a European thing, but I walk around the city of Skopje, which has been around since Roman times, and I think, yeah, a Roman soldier or a peasant or whatever walked once where I walked. And this is not a particularly negative thought, but you are drawn in by the melancholia of it all and the weight of all those many, many years of history just starts pressing down on you. And I always thought of myself like being Macedonian. You have the choice. You can live in Alexander's shadow, or you can live on Alexander. You can stand on Alexander's shoulders. And most of us just languish in the man's shadow. I suspect that, Mongolians feel the same way about Genghis Khan, or Italians about Caesar, or Hungarians about Bela Lugosi. It's one of those. Well, greatest Hungarian ever. Who is it? Attila, Lugosi, maybe Arpad, who knows? It's one of those things.
I also thought it was interesting at the end, when they did get into the new thought, they mentioned the fact that Trump is known to be a fan of Norman Vincent Peale, who was sort of a popularizer of new thought in the U.S. And you don't hear so much about it these days, but back in 2016, 2017, when Trump won the election, James was at the forefront of speculating on the connection between new thought and meme magic and the alt-right and Trump's victory and how they could be connected. And I think that there may be something to that. It's not even necessarily something mystical, just that in order for people to for something, a new vision to be realized, you have to be willing to believe in it. And whether it's a mystical force or just the fact that it motivates people more strongly, it does seem to have played a role. I just wish that the final product that we ended up getting had been better than what the 4 years of Trump ended up being.
It's not necessarily, I guess, mystical. If we're keeping with the Godardian view, the Neville's view of the Bible, this is a manual on how to use your brain. Mm-hmm. This is actually something I was told in when I was starting out as an insurance salesman. You know, if you want to be successful at your job, visualize yourself as a successful person, and not just successful in the theoretical. Visualize yourself as successful enough to purchase a Lamborghini or something like that. It has to be a specific thing that enters your mind, because that gives your mind focus. When your mind has focus, you're working towards. You're not just working for, and where you're working towards. Actually, working is easier. It's less of an effort, less of a chore. It's just a basic psychology, you could say. But I will say, I think I agree about the Trump part, because we actually have failure analysis of his campaign in 2020. You know? Mm. What happened was, I have a friend who pointed out, like, he's an American, that the aesthetics of the 2016 campaign were very different from the aesthetics of the 2020 campaign. The aesthetics of the 2016 campaign were, we remember Fashwave, it was very retro, it was, I think, Patrick Bateman, it was Pepe memes, it was actually very youthful, very energetic. You had this exciting new thing is coming about. Whereas the aesthetics of 2020 was evangelical megachurch and GOP conventions and, these ancient donors, this people like Sheldon Adelson and basically, Judeo-conservatism. It was stuffy, it was stodgy, it was boring, it was cringe, as kids like to say. Trump had that spiritual advisor woman going haka paka waka waka, summoning angels from Africa, summoning angels from South America. I know that he didn't lose the election, but I could see the universe conspiring to prevent the victory of such, industrial grade cringe in any way possible. I mean, just call me a superstitious man, but I think that Trump brought this on himself by embracing the cringe of the GOP, where he should have just kept on. Like, even if he had done nothing, if he had just retained the aesthetics of 2016, I don't think he would have lost. But no, he actually had to let the cringe into his heart, and he lost in 2020. He's no longer the president. Don't get technical with me about election fraud. We knew it took place. But, it is what it is, I guess.
Oh, you wouldn't hear me doubt that. I mean, Greg Johnson is fond of saying, and I think he's right, that Trump ran as a populist in 2016 and he ran as a conservative in 2020, which is why it's disturbing that Trump got 10 million more votes in 2020 as a conservative. But that's a whole other issue. But I don't know if I really believe that Trump saw himself as being on any sort of mission. But I think the difference in the aesthetics, especially on the alt-right, I mean, I don't believe the alt-right elected Trump in 2016 by any stretch, but there was a certain energy and aesthetic around Trump at that time that, as you said, was absent in 2020. And I think the reason is just that Trump was an unknown factor. I mean, apart from his business career, he had no political record. So basically people could read into him whatever they wanted. And then when we were confronted with the reality of Trump in 2020, it was 4 years of not particularly impressive achievements and rhetoric. So I think it became much harder for him to become that symbol who people wanted to meme into office, as it were. But it'll be interesting to see if we can do that again. I don't know if, again, I think the lesson that we have to derive from the last 5 or 10 years is simply that we can't wait on politicians or a political party to save us. We have to, that's what we're doing on shows like this, trying to create a new paradigm for the right. And I think Trump was important for us in 2016 because he showed that more things were possible than we had been led to believe in American politics for several decades before that. And in that sense, he had value, even if his presidency in the end ended up being very disappointing. But we have to understand that there aren't politicians coming to save us. We have to, maybe I'm getting a little too far afield from the subject of the article, but I would say it's a cliche, but they say, be the change you want to see in the world. I think that's what we have to do. We have to embody the values and the aesthetics that we want to see, even if they're not going to become the dominant paradigm anytime soon. So we have to prepare for the possibility that we might be out of power for a very long time. But as individuals, we're still free, at least for now. And we can still do things like this program and many other activities that writers are engaged in now with writing, creating art, publishing, all these different things. These are things you can do to actualize the world that we all dreamed of, perhaps briefly in 2016. But now, I'm getting way off the track here. So,
well, there is no track. The writer's block is not a train. It's not even a car. It's a rickety old Lada Niva with the back seats removed, and we're smuggling the samizdat right to your doorstep. We can also.
It's not a Trabant. Sugar.
What? No, it's not a Trabant. The Trabant does not have off-road capability, and of course, it's just the aesthetics of a Lada Niva with the back seats ripped out and replaced with a storage area is just so much. We can get you sugar, we can get you butter, we can get you booze, we can get you hookers, we can even get you a nuclear device for the right price. I give you a very good price for nuclear device, but most of the time we deliver to you samizdat, distant literature and views, and of course we are developing or I hope you are developing salon culture for the new right, for the distant right, for whatever the fuck we call ourselves these days. And we've been going on for 2 hours, so I don't really expect my guests to keep on the track. There is no track. We are off-roading, gentlemen. I have the big tires on this show for that specific reason. And this is why I installed the four-wheel drive. Okay, my metaphor is getting away from me. We've been talking for 2 hours. John, I think it's time to just bring it all in, bring it home. What would you say as your parting words while I check the donations?
I've been doing this work now, like I said, for about 15 years in various, I participated in various enterprises and venues and genres and types of work that I've done. And I would say that in the end, if this ultimately coalesces into some kind of a movement, that's great. But in the end, what I really see myself doing is just trying to reach in like-minded individuals. That I think the importance of this type of work is just showing people that they're not alone. I mean, I remember when I first realized that I was becoming a right winger when I was like 19. In that period, that as somebody who grew up in New York and was quite thoroughly brainwashed. I thought, am I mentally ill? Is there something wrong with me? We didn't have any internet then. There was no right wing culture. Like,
can you please repeat it for me in the Brooklyn accent? In the whole.
Well, I'm not from Brooklyn.
Am I mentally? Oh yeah. I forget. But you know, I've been watching Seinfeld.
I grew up on Long Island, but but yeah, I wish that I had had the resources that young people do now to be able to reach out to other people who think the same way and to conspire and to realize that they're not alone. That's how I see the work that I'm doing. I really hope that we do see some sort of a socio-political breakthrough in our lifetimes. But if we don't, I think we can still help each other. And if there's anything good in this godforsaken world of technology that we find ourselves in, it's that it's not so difficult to do things such as this anymore.
Yeah. Well, it is a very good note to end this thing on. It's something I've been trying to tell people. You're not stupid, you're not crazy, and you're not alone. It took me a very long time to accept these three notions, that I'm not stupid, I'm not crazy, I'm not alone, especially because I actually am crazy. So, you know, two out of three ain't bad. I think Meatloaf said that. God rest you. Anyways, but yeah, I think you are right. I think the real meme magic is the friends we made along the way, and we still have many friends to make along the way. It's always like that. You know, you suffer in this mortal coil, but it has its moments. It has its moments of deep friendship, of camaraderie, of fighting together against a common enemy, of looking for truth in a fundamentally false world, and looking for a kind of freedom to say, to speak the truth, since we are compelled to lie in order to survive. It is very humiliating. People are clamoring for two more hours, and they have been discussing apparently the role of MK Ultra in the 1960s counterculture, which, yeah. I think it's because we mentioned Frank Zappa. His father was MK Ultra. His father really was MK Ultra. That's the other thing. But you know,
and Jim Morrison's father was what, some kind of a grand admiral in the U.S. Navy. Yeah, there are some interesting connections there.
Yeah,
I don't know. Having tried psychedelics myself, I don't believe it's all a conspiracy. there is something useful to be found there.
I wouldn't know. I'm always afraid of these types of drugs. People are saying to me that it's because I'm a control freak, right? I say I'm not a control freak. I have a type A personality. I'm a command enthusiast, right? So the proper term is control enthusiast. But it is getting late. We are not made of metal. We are also not made of rubber. We are men of flesh and bone, even though we are content creators and talking heads on your rank or in your pleasure rectangle. So yeah, this has been the Writer's Block, and we've hosted John Morgan for the best month ever, which was April. And I want to thank John for appearing and having these lovely 2 hours with us. I want to thank my pleasure too, John. I want to thank everyone who donated. I want to thank everyone who tuned in to listen. Everyone commenting in the chat. I want to thank our courageous and heroic moderators, Gaddis Maximus and Bartleby, for absolutely dominating chat, just eliminating all of the bad faith actors over there trying to lead our people astray. And with that, people, all I can really say is bye-bye. Bye-bye.